and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, where your investments help support the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Thursday, October 3rd, we're studying Numbers chapter 7, verses 1 to 89. In today's text, the tribes of Israel bring gifts to be used by the Levites in their service, and they bring offerings for the dedication of the altar on the day it was anointed. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us returning guest, the Reverend Dr. Ryan Teets. Dr. Teets serves as Associate Professor of Exegetical Theology and Dean of Students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Teets, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Oh, it's always fun to come back, even in a text that's, 89 verses long, as I accidentally discovered 2 days ago when I realized what exactly we were covering. So this is going to be a fun adventure today. I'm looking forward to being able to tackle this with you.
We recently studied Psalm 119, which is the longest chapter in the Scriptures, and we spent 22 days doing that. Today we have the second longest chapter in the Scriptures, and we're going to cover it in less than an hour. So buckle up.
Yep, no pressure.
So talk to us a little bit about the book of Numbers and the context as we prepare to look at this chapter.
Yeah, and that's big here. It's been a while since I've taught Numbers. I, first of all, always balk at the term Numbers. I teach Hebrew poetry for a living, So calling it Numbers already makes it like a book that isn't all that interesting. Arithmoi isn't all that great. It refers to the two censuses that happen in the book. The Hebrew name may actually help us a bit more. It's Bamidbar is the name in Hebrew for the book of Numbers, in the wilderness, which at least gives us a better sense of the purpose of this book. This is that book that takes us from Sinai to the brink of the Promised Land. So Bamidbar actually works a little bit better. And once we're dealing with that Midbar, the wilderness theme, it really puts us into more or less the second half of the book. This is the journey which God's people are tested, failed, and fail miserably, except for the remnant that's preserved. So frankly, when I agreed to do Bamidbar, I thought for sure this is going to be one of those fun, it's going to be Balaam or the serpents. Instead, we get the rededication of the temple, which brings to the third point in terms of just getting our feel for this book called Bamidbar. If you call it Arithmoi Numbers, okay, two censuses, it doesn't really do it justice. If we call it In the Wilderness, using the Hebrew name, it sends us into the language of God's, of the people being tested and essentially failing, except for the remnant. Instead, a good chunk of this book at the beginning, and what we're dealing with today with these 89 verses, is actually a lot about the camp. So perhaps a better way to understand this book, and I'm not proposing a new name for the book, that would probably get me into trouble. I was already radical enough calling it Bamidbar, I realize, is calling it The Camp. So this book is really the enactment of everything we've seen so far in the Torah. So if Genesis has given us our beginnings, Exodus gave us the great saving event, with the building of the tabernacle and its dedication mentioned for the first time, and then Leviticus, we have our second dedication of the temple. We're going to go for three strikes today or whatever with this text. So Leviticus was all about God's presence, the establishment of the priesthood. Now the book of Numbers is the constitution of the entirety of God's people. So all of these promises and all of these things that were stated at Sinai are now coming into fruition. And we'll see a bit of a much broader scope in terms of who's even involved with the dedication of the tabernacle and this third account of it here in Numbers.
Okay, so thinking through the three accounts in the books of Moses, the first is Exodus 40, right?
Yeah.
So that's where the tabernacle is set up and the glory of the Lord descends on the tabernacle in the cloud. The second is that Leviticus, what, 8 and 9? Is that the...
Sounds about right.
Okay, and that's where it's been a while since I've read that part of Leviticus, but don't the people see the glory of the Lord this is the verse I was thinking of. Leviticus 9:23. Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. When they came out and they blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from before the Lord. So, okay, this is the connection I want to make, because I have read all 89 verses of number 7 already, as you have, Dr. Teets. In each of the previous dedication accounts, you have the Lord manifesting himself in some way to the people. At the end of this text, we're going to get what I think is a very significant verse in verse 89, the last verse of the chapter, where Moses hears the voice of the Lord speaking to him from above the mercy seat. So, the reason I bring that up is because I think it helps these be more than, hey, let's all go to the church dedication service, but the Lord is doing something very significant here in his tabernacle, and he shows it each time it's dedicated here in the wilderness.
Yeah, and we're actually dealing with a flashback here. So what we've done is we've gone from the Aaronic benediction in chapter 6, and now, so Moses is actually going to a flashback. So we're talking the same event recounted three times.
Gotcha, okay.
And in each time, there's a different emphasis. And you picked up on it really well, because verse 88, 89 are the punchline.
Yeah.
It's really where this, after all of a, well, shall we say, detailed liturgical stuff over and over again that we'll look at, is that if we think about Exodus having a strong emphasis upon the role of Moses, and we see that actually in the Exodus 40 account, where Moses is the one who's involved, it also leaves us hanging in the sense that God's presence is there, but nobody can go in. So it now sets us up then for the Leviticus as it recounts it. And you point out really well, it's the people are seeing, but also it's the prominence of the priesthood.
Right.
So we move from Moses to now God's presence in Leviticus. But then you're right, here in Numbers chapter 7, we don't get any sort of theophany. We're not talking any divine manifestation. Instead, we go from God's presence in Leviticus to now an emphasis of God's ongoing leadership of the people on their journey.
Yeah.
So the voice of God speaking from the atonement seat is huge here. And that's part of Numbers' emphasis. This is the people are following their true king as he leads them through the wilderness.
All right, let's go ahead and start reading this chapter. I'm going to begin reading here in verse 1 of Numbers chapter 7. On the day when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle and had anointed and consecrated it with all its furnishings and had anointed and consecrated the altar with all its utensils, the chiefs of Israel, heads of their fathers' houses, who were the chiefs of the tribes, who were over those who were listed, approached and brought their offerings before the Lord, 6 wagons and 12 oxen, a wagon for every 2 of the chiefs, and for each one an ox. They brought them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Accept these from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, and give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service." So Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 wagons and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon, according to their service, and 4 wagons and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. But to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because they were charged with the service of the holy things that had to be carried on the shoulder. And the chiefs offered offerings for the dedication of the altar on the day it was anointed, and the chiefs offered their offering before the altar. And the Lord said to Moses, "They shall offer their offerings, 1 chief each day, for the dedication of the altar." I'll pause there. That takes us through verse 11. After this, we're going to come into a long section of what that offering was for each of the successive days. But before we get there, so we've got these first 11 verses that set the stage for that. As you pointed out, Dr. Teets, we are on that day when Moses finished setting up the tabernacle. He had anointed, consecrated it with all the furnishings, the altar, its utensils. That's the day we are, so we're in a flashback. Is there anything more on that day from the previous account of it that we need to remember as we look at this chapter?
Yeah, the issue now becomes, this is where we talk about tabernacle theology, or really the previous book, Leviticus, being really filled with absolute gospel, which is, as somebody who once quipped when he was a new pastor, we're trying to get through the quick guided tour of the Bible, Leviticus, who needs this book, only to find out that it was the head of the LWML's favorite book. Yeah, I've been doing
one in that one.
I have been doing penance over that comment for about 18 years now. And frankly, the head of the WML had a point, had a great point. One of the joys of being a pastor is you have those wonderful saints who have been dwelling in the Bible longer than I have, and they just have this great wisdom. Yeah. And the reason Alice knew it was that Leviticus is all about God wants to dwell with us. It's that holiness language, which is great, except for the fact who can dwell with a holy God when you're not a holy people, when you're not holy yourself. So it's all about how God is providing the means by which people can dwell with him and not be destroyed. So it's all about providing the means of salvation here. So now we have this flashback, and they're getting ready to... dedication is used often to describe this. Probably a better way is to refer to it as the initiation of the tabernacle. So it's not just like, I mean, we dedicate buildings all the time in different institutions. It's not putting a name plaque on it saying that you can never remove because somebody donated it from 100 years ago and some family members still exist. It's not that idea. Instead, the temple is now being put into a spot by which it's now going to function as the means by which God saves his people, the means of atonement here. So this is a huge thing going on here. But not only is it the temple or the tabernacle, I gotta watch that today, the tabernacle being set up, but it also means that God's going to be on the move and God's going to dwell with the people as he leads them throughout their entire journey here. So yeah, it's a lot of get up and go here. It's a very, by the way, a piece of Hebrew trivia, the word for wagon is one that nobody quite knows what to do with. It's not your typical word for wagon. It seems to be a possible pun on the word for turtle. How's that for useless trivia that'll impress nobody? So covered wagon, perhaps. If you're looking for something exegetically significant on that, it's not. I just am a Hebrew dork every so often.
Okay. All right. So here we are at the tabernacle is being set up for use. It's going to be used for what God has intended it to be used. And the first thing that happens, as all of the furnishings, you can read more about those in Exodus, all of those things are there. The chiefs of Israel come with these wagons and these oxen, whatever those wagons are exactly, and they're given to the Levites so that the Levites can do the jobs that were described back in chapters 3 and 4, although not everybody needs a wagon or an oxen for this. And I think that's the first part here, before we get into the offerings that are very repetitive later, we've got these wagons, these oxen being given to the Levites to help them do their jobs. Well, what's going on here?
Yeah. We should keep in mind that right before this, we had the Aaronic benediction.
Right.
So, Lord bless you, keep you. It's this, the part of Numbers everybody knows, but half the time most people don't realize it's in the book of Numbers.
Yeah.
So it's this enactment of actually the Aaronic benediction that we use in church, countless times. Is that, now we have the people that have been set apart, the Levites. The odd thing is we have the one group that almost gets either in a privileged position or snubbed. We have the Korathites. Apparently they have a special job, but they don't carry too much. But all of this is to enable, it's the enabling of God's agents here. And the big thing here, and this is going to get into this pretty significant verbatim repetition coming up, is that we have all of the leaders are gathered here. And this gets into that idea that perhaps a different way of describing the name of the book would be the camp. This isn't just the Levites, it's not Moses, it's everybody involved. So this emphasis upon the entirety of God's people unified around God's means of grace.
Hmm. Yeah, the Kohathites, as we discovered back in chapter 4 especially, they're the ones that have charge for carrying the holy things, those furnishings that are the closest to the Lord's presence. And so there were particular instructions for the priests ahead of time how to prepare those things so that the Kohathites could go carry them without dying. And so, again, to see how they're singled out here, are they being snubbed or not? I think this is just the reality of the task they've been given, and they don't do it with oxen. They carry the stuff with poles in different ways just because of the nature of what it is. But I like the way you said the enabling of God's agents, so that God has given these tasks, and now through the support of his people, he enables them to do those things. He's the one that provides the means for doing the things he wants his people to do.
Yeah, and that's really the power of of this text. It's the power of so much of that, the part of the Pentateuch that, oh, because it's so detailed with all of the liturgical talk, and okay, I gotta get this out of my system. The cult language, and again, hearers, I was told my students yesterday I was gonna probably use this term, and I would have to qualify it. I'm gonna use the word cult. Everybody who's listening to this, please don't panic. I'm not referring to Ouija boards. Cult is it's a generic term for worship practices. You could almost go liturgy, if you will. So really, it's this enabling of the cult here. Again, don't panic. It's all the worship stuff they're supposed to do. It's the liturgy, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. And this in a very practical way, here at the outset at least, you know, I mean, wagons and oxen for carrying the pillars and the various coverings of the tabernacle, very practical use that all the people of Israel assist their brothers, the Levites, in doing this. I think, I mean, and I hope this isn't too far afield, but you think about the way that the church functions here. You have the Levites who have been tasked with carrying the holy things. They've been set apart by God for this very purpose. You know, they're not camped outside. They're right next to the tabernacle as they camp. And yet the rest of the people assist them in that work. And so there is I know there's not a direct line from priests, Levites to pastors today, but I think we can make this application that you see the church as a whole, both past clergy and people, functioning together for the sake of the good of the church.
Oh, completely. So, I mean, God's people have functioned in the same pattern over and over again. So God's people are always going to be where God's word is proclaimed and the means of grace are. So Old Testament is going to be the tabernacle temple, but that points to the great ultimate sacrifice, the once and for all sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And yeah, it's not just the Levites aren't these trained professionals who do everything. It is everybody involved, because it's part of being part of God's people, part of being the community united around God's means of grace.
Okay, so I've read the first 11 verses. It's in verse 10 where we step aside from looking at wagons and oxen who are given to the Levites to carry out their service. And in verse 10, now the chiefs are going to step forward to bring their offerings for the dedication of the altar on the day that it was anointed. It is to happen one every day, as we're going to see when we read it. Anything in verses 10 and 11 that we need to see to set the stage for what comes next in this lengthy chapter?
The question that comes to mind on this is, at the risk of being myself in trouble, Moses could have used an editor and made this a lot shorter.
Okay.
Yeah. As you read it out loud, a couple of my students said that this apparently was their daily reading as in their daily lectionary a few weeks ago, and they said when they found out what I was doing, and then I said, oh, it's that chapter. In many ways, you could have, which really inspired confidence. By the way, I love my students dearly most of the time. Is that you can, in many ways, could say these 12 guys on subsequent days did this exact same thing. Okay. So it raises a question for us to ponder as you now read aloud this text. Yep. Of why do we need this extensive verbatim repetition? There's repetition in the Bible, but in terms of verbatim repetition, this is absolutely unique to the entire Old Testament. It's cut and paste. You change the day, you change the person. Everything else is exactly the same. And that raises a question of, sort of tongue-in-cheek, Moses could have simplified it.
Yeah. Why?
But instead, why? I mean, there is a literary point to Moses' message here. Okay. And that's going to be something we have to wrestle with.
All right, that sounds good. Well, I'll go ahead and read that so that we get the sense of this. Let's see, I'm looking at my timer. We've got about 7 or so minutes on this side of the break, so I'm not sure how long this is going to take me to read out loud, but I'm going to get started. I'm going to get started here. So this is at verse 12 now in Numbers chapter 7. He who offered his offering the first day was Nahshon, the son of Aminadab, of the tribe of Judah. And his offering was one silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Nashon the son of Amminadab. On the second day, Nethanel the son of Zuar, the chief of Issachar, made an offering. He offered for his offering one silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Nethanel, the son of Zuar. On the third day, Eliab, the son of Helon, the chief of the people of Zebulun, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. On the fourth day, Eleazar, the son of Shedeur, the chief of the people of Reuben, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eleazar, the son of Shedeur. On the fifth day, Shelumiel, the son of Zerishaddai, the chief of the people of Simeon, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. On the sixth day, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, the chief of the people of Gad, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. On the seventh day, Elishama, the son of Amihud, the chief of the people of Ephraim, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Elishama, the son of Amihud. On the eighth day, Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, the chief of the people of Manasseh, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur. On the ninth day, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, the chief of the people of Benjamin. His offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Abidan, the son of Gideoni. On the tenth day, Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai, the chief of the people of Dan, His offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels, full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai. On the 11th day, Pagiel, the son of Achran, the chief of the people of Asher. His offering was one silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels, full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Pagiel, the son of Achran. On the 12th day, Ahira, the son of Enan, the chief of the people of Naphtali. His offering was one silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels, full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. That takes us through verse 83. That is where the repetition ends. We're going to get a summary of that in the rest of the chapter, and that takes us right about to our break. So we'll pause there, and we'll talk about those verses on the other side. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to the Reverend Dr. Ryan Teets this morning. We will be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Thursday, October 3rd. We're studying Numbers chapter 7, verses 1 to 89 with the Reverend Dr. Ryan Teets. He is Associate Professor of Exegetical Theology and Dean of Students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Teets, prior to the break, I read Numbers 7, verses 12 to 83, the 12 days of offerings that are brought before the Lord for the dedication of the altar on the day that it was anointed. Before I read that, you invited us to ponder why Moses records it in this way, why he doesn't edit it to say, on 12 successive days, these 12 men brought this offering and call. How many verses do you save there? You save, 60 verses probably. So
you cut it down by 11/12.
So let's ponder that. What is the effect? What is gained by repeating it one day after another in the manner that Moses writes it?
Yeah. Frankly, for us as hearers, it was the, okay, oh, I was thinking, am I ever going to get a chance to talk while you were reading it out loud? I'm like, well, I really want to, I was dying to get a word in edgewise at some point. So for us as hearers who aren't accustomed to this format, it really was this, again and again and again. Hebrew narrative does use repetition fairly often, but not in this way. So we'll have these so-called type scenes where we'll have a patrol scenes. It'll be a very similar thing over and over again with variation. And that's a completely different beast here, where we see a similar story happening. Again, it causes us to compare the two. That's not what this is. I mean, this is, as you noticed when you were reading out loud, as our hearers heard, it is absolutely identical, which makes this as some sort of epic inventory. What Moses wants us to do is to actually ponder each one of these massive gifts. And you think for his original hearers, it's a chance for them to be able to see exactly what their tribe contributed to. So you can almost imagine who should I pick on? We'll go with the Ephraimites, because I just happen to be seeing them the first on the page I'm looking at. So it's the Ephraimites' turn, and they're like, oh yeah, we did this. This was our participation. And each tribe is now equally honored. At the very brink of the tent of meeting of the tabernacle. So it is this idea of all the 12 tribes are doing the exact same thing. They are giving lavish gifts here. And these gifts are extraordinary. They're being given to the tabernacle. So you can see this great sense of an epic unity of the people. And it's a moment that we as hearers can actually kind of step back and savor, if you will, which, again, given the length and the repetition, may be a little hard for us. But we can take a deep breath and say, look, this is how things were supposed to be. God's people have been constituted at Sinai. And now, who are they? They're the ones who are all unified together around the tabernacle, around God's gracious presence. So it is this great moment of triumph. Hence why Moses gives us this, I really like that language of epic inventory. It's Robert Alter is the one who actually uses that term, because it really helps us get this almost majestic scope of those, lot of verses. I'm not going to do the math in the file.
Okay, so we have an epic inventory of the gifts of God's people. They are all the same gift that is brought one day after another. On a number of occasions, Dr. Teets, you said that this is a lavish gift, a massive gift. Talk to us, again, I read it 12 times. Talk to us about the actual gift and why you say it's so massive. I don't know that we don't know what the shekel of the sanctuary is. Most of us don't measure that way today. So how lavish of a gift are we talking here? What are the details?
Forget about the silver and the gold. I mean, that's a big deal here. It's actually more the animals. If you could imagine what this would have looked like, this gets into that really epic scope here. We take animals perhaps for granted. I freely admit that I usually start out with the meat when I cook for my family. Yeah. Is that especially when it comes to our larger four-footed creatures, the bulls and the cattle, is that we have this language. These are huge uses of resources to actually keep these animals going. So, Ed, I would love to. We just can't even imagine what this would have really looked like, because we kind of jumping ahead to where Moses is nice enough to give us the total. We have
verse 87. It looks like, if we're talking about animals especially, verse 87 tells us there are 12 bulls, 12 rams, 12 male lambs a year old with the grain offering, 12 male goats, that's the sin offering. Then he says, all the cattle for the sacrifice of peace offerings, that you've got 24 bulls, 60 rams, 60 male goats, and 60 male lambs a year old. I didn't add all those up in my head, but
right.
Big numbers still.
Thank goodness Moses in the book called Numbers actually gave us that number this time.
It's helpful.
So these are animals that are not going to be used for food. Instead, these are animals that are completely devoted to the worship life of God's people. And then trying to figure out exactly how heavy a shekel is, but you can just hear those numbers, and they're huge. That's a lot of gold. It's a lot of silver. We talk about the tabernacle, the temple, the tabernacle worship, the atoning sacrifices. It's one involving blood, so hence the animals, and two, it involves just this absolute otherness and majesty of God. Hence the use of only the finest things, only the most precious things.
So let me, just to try to, again, put this in the context of this repetition and what that communicates to us. So with the great value that we see in these gifts, the Lord, I think, would teach us the great value of what happens in the tabernacle. What's the big thing happening in Israel? What's the most important and most valuable thing that Israel has going for it? It's what happens here in the tabernacle. For all of the numbers that we've heard so far, when it comes to the counting of the people, which those have been some big numbers too, and there was some repetition there in chapter 1 in the census, although it wasn't quite this lengthy, there was some repetition there that you can get into a rhythm as you read it out loud. The real value of Israel, or the valuable thing that's happening in Israel, is what's happening here in the tabernacle, in the sanctuary. And so by repeating that great value over and over, and then getting those summaries that I mentioned, and we'll read in a little while, you see even in the fuller extent the great value of what happens in the tabernacle. And I think it hits home a lot more by repeating it than it would if you just had the summary that's there at the end.
Oh, exactly. And part of the repetition isn't just the, okay, here's the gift, the one silver silver basin. It is everything's associated with a very, very specific part of the sacrificial system. And that's, we need to keep that in mind, that this is the enabling of the entire sacrificial system. So we have the enabling of the meal offering, the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the peace offering with every one of these. So God's people are contributing, with the result that all of these sacrifices that are quite literally a matter of life or death are able to happen.
Okay, so another effect of having the full list repeated 12 times in a row is to communicate the completeness of what God is doing, if I can say it that way. The people of Israel are not left wondering after you've read Numbers chapter 7, do we have what we need for the peace offerings? If we need a sin offering, are we going to have what we need? If we need the incense, are we going to be able to burn it? The Lord provides for everything that is needed for the worship life of his people, for him to give these life-giving gifts among his people. There's this overwhelming sense of completeness that God has taken care of every single detail. Don't worry, he will be able to give his gifts to you here in the tabernacle.
And I'd even take it one step further. Let's go with overwhelming sense of trustworthiness.
Okay.
A holy God, we've gone back to that a couple times. A holy God is a God who wants to dwell with us is absolutely amazing until we look at our own sin. And then a God who wants to dwell with us is absolutely terrifying. So how can we stand? So now we have the completeness and the certainty that we can dwell with God because God is faithful in providing the means. And yeah, we end up with a fully stocked temple, a herd that'll provide all the sacrifices, well-stocked incense, which is a phrase I don't know if I've ever used, and every one of these. So we need to have the meal offering. I mean, that is that great moment of fellowship that happens so often. The burnt offering, which is Atonement 101, that offering that causes that whenever we offer a burnt offering in the Old Testament, it is... Oh, provides atonement for sin, but also a way to plead to God for God to pay attention and care for us. Then, lest we forget the biggie, and every one of these is big in its own way, we also have that sin offering that is enabled. And that sin offering, that's the Day of Atonement here. It's the heart of Leviticus, for crying out loud. And then we have that peace offering, which is a way of people experiencing fellowship with each other and with their God. Having all of these in place is life, and knowing that it'll happen. Because if this doesn't happen, they're doomed, and they know it.
Yeah. So, and just to, you've used the phrase well-stocked on a number of the elements here, including the incense. We're not well-stocked with incense here at Faith Godfrey. We don't use incense, but.
We are quite well-stocked at Concordia Theological Seminary.
Good to know.
Just so you know.
So, but the thought with well-stocked, just so that we have a sense of how this chapter is progressing and what it's describing, when it goes day by day with the offering repeated, and this is what's brought, it is, we're not seeing these animals sacrificed each day, but this is providing for a stock of animals that will be used in the ongoing work of the tabernacle as it progresses, right? I mean, so it's not a day after day, this is what's sacrificed, but here's what's brought day after day to be stocked for the sake of offering sacrifices in an ongoing fashion.
Yeah, completely. Okay. Yeah. So, and hence why we have that, and it really gets into that final list there. It's right. Okay, everything's totaled up. The certainty that we will be able to experience God's means of grace, because we have all the stuff we need. And also the ongoing commitment of God's people to the tabernacle as well. These are, and that really gets into why, I'm convinced one of my indicators of my spiritual health is my financial stewardship to kind of go, is that what I do with my gifts tells you a lot about what my faith is and where, and yeah, it describes, how much do I trust God? Well, if I'm able to not stockpile my resources, instead be a good steward and give them back to God, that's a pretty powerful statement of faith, and the people are making it here.
Yeah. So, and I think that thought helps us to get a sense of also why the one day after another, this repetition, it does happen on successive day, on the first day, the second day, and all the way to the 12th day, that one day after another is a regular giving of these gifts that would not have been as powerfully communicated, I think, if you only get the summary on 12 successive days. When you get on the first day, this is brought. On the second day, this is brought. On the third day, this is brought. All the way to the 12th day, it is an ongoing, regular stewardship that is providing the things needed for the tabernacle, these gifts that God then turns around and gives to you, his life-giving gifts. It's a daily thing. So not only is it a complete trustworthiness, as we were talking about, but this is a daily ongoing thing, that God's presence isn't just a summary, hey, he's done this for you your whole life. But no, day one, day two, day three, God is right there with his gifts each and every day, and that repetition emphasizes that.
Yeah, I don't think any of us as pastors would ever want to attempt to do a stewardship sermon on this text, but you could actually pull it off pretty well.
You might, yeah.
Because it really is that whole, the essence of what Christian stewardship is. It is the, okay, God, I trust you. And having that, and as much as I wanted to quip about, could have Moses summarized faster? And, frankly, I felt really bad for you trying to read the, you did it, you timed it brilliantly. I was impressed. And it gave me a chance to drink some coffee because I knew I had time. So there is this element, though, of, okay, everything's happening, and now the next step is, okay, now I'm going to participate too. And it really does help us appreciate, and God's, and the original hearers as well, okay, this is what it means to have God with us. This is what it means for us to trust, and this is what it means for us to support.
Yeah, yeah, and I like what you said. Now it's going to be my turn too. So each tribe gets to bring something, and they know they're not going to be left out of the gift to the tabernacle, nor are they going to be left out from the gifts received from the tabernacle. So every tribe gets its turn in a wonderful way. The entire body of Christ participates in the giving, and then even more importantly, participates in the receiving of the gifts.
Yeah, I mean, the language of communion here, both in this, is just absolutely rich. We think about the Lord's Supper, we have what unity with God, and because of that, we have unity with each other. The language of the Lord's Supper, we see it here demonstrated in a very powerful way as it went over and over again. And I really wish I could have been there to see this. If you can imagine what this would have looked like, every day you see this happening, and you're now part of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, imagine you're in one of the later tribes, one of the, day 10, 11, 12. You've been watching this one after another. I think there would build this sense of anticipation. Now it's our turn. In a way that is reminiscent of the way St. Paul, I think it's in 2 Corinthians, I forget which church it is, that you know, wants the opportunity to participate in this offering. They're begging him for the opportunity to be generous. I think that the repetition of this chapter instills that same sort of, hey, it's my turn now. I get to give toward the tabernacle. And I think that would also carry over, not just for the 12 days that are described here, but even beyond this, because for as big of a stockpile as we've got by the end of the chapter, that's going to get used up, and there's going to be need for continued offerings, such that the repetition that is used in this chapter, I think, inspires continued generosity in the days to come.
Generosity and the joy of giving here. It's, yeah, you're right. I would love to have been one of the later tribes there. Okay, it's my turn. It's my turn. Me too. Me too. Can I do this now? Let me go for it. And then it gets to be your turn. Yeah. We so often think of stewardship and I mean, they're making huge sacrifices here. Giving up livestock is a big deal here.
Yeah.
Which is so funny for me to focus on livestock and not the gold and the silver.
Sure.
Is this a joy to participate, because here you are, you're part of it, you have ownership of it, if you will, and what are you doing? You're there gathering around God's gifts, knowing that even though you've given up your livestock, your silver and your gold, that you're around a God who you can trust, one, to make it so you can dwell with him, and two, as we start heading towards the end of this chapter, is that here's a God who's going to not only allow you to dwell with him, but also now lead you throughout your entire journey until you make it to the promised land.
Mm. Now, I know we haven't said too much about the order. As I was reading, these are names that have come up previously in the book of Numbers. I think we've got the same order of tribes as we've seen previously. Judah goes first, which is consistent throughout. Is there anything in the ordering that you'd like to... I mean, we talked about these in previous episodes, but if you had any thoughts on the ordering of the tribes here or any of the particulars of the tribes, feel free to make a few comments.
This always makes me nervous. I have moments when I teach a class where the students have this odd giggle, which means I've usually contradicted a colleague and didn't even know it. I usually will fess up to it. Probably the one thing that needs to be stated is the prominence of Judah here.
Sure.
And that's really the starting with Judah, it's, I say Judah. Ephraim is going to end up being a very powerful tribe with the Northern Kingdom later associations. But no, this is the tribe of Judah. And having that be really the highlight of where God's promises are going to be is pretty helpful here.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, as we pointed out, even with the prominence of Judah, in this chapter, everybody gives the exact same thing. There's not a special offering that Judah has in this case. It's the entire people of God here receiving his gifts.
Yeah. Going first in some ways probably doesn't even matter here. You're right. Yeah. This has been... It's really the equality and unity of God's people here that Numbers has just been emphasizing. And that's part of, and that's really why I can't believe I'm going to say this. I absolutely love this chapter for that reason.
It's been great. Yeah.
Oh, it's, yeah. In spite of the fact that
we haven't even gotten to the best verse yet.
Yeah, no kidding. And we better get to that last verse, but it really is all of these things that we've been seeing in the Torah and in Exodus and Leviticus, and now finally we have it. It's God's people unified around God's gifts. I mean, this is the picture of the church here.
So, Dr. Teeks, I'm gonna ask a question that I really don't know the answer to. I'm not sure if the text says it or not, but with the 12 days successively, does that mean that one of these days is the Sabbath day? And the offering was brought on a Sabbath day, or should we? I was thinking with 12 days, I suppose you could take the Sabbaths off, and then you've got two full weeks. So, you have any indication in the text as to? I don't know that it's important, but it's a curious detail that entered my mind, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts.
And that's a great curious detail to enter your mind. Milgram, there are a couple good, really good Numbers commentaries out there. Milgram in the new NJPS series. So a Jewish scholar who does some really good linguistic work, he actually wrestled with that because he had the whole, what are you doing with working on the Shabbat?
Yeah.
And he notes, and he argues, and this is following the text, is that because this event is so momentous, they actually get a Sabbath exemption here.
Okay. It doesn't bother me either way, because you know, I've got the New Testament, and so like if the Lord chooses to allow work on the Sabbath here, it doesn't bother me. But I was just curious, because there's some pretty strict prohibitions on the Sabbath elsewhere, and I just didn't know how that fit here.
And that actually, and this is what Milgram argues, is that this ends up highlighting the extraordinariness of this event.
Okay.
Yeah, this is not normal. This shouldn't normally happen. But because the initiation of the temple so that God's people can receive God's gifts, and as they're all gathered around, that's why we have this very, and you pointed out very well, this highly unusual use of, I mean, we can definitely agree, it's always hard to figure out what work is on the Sabbath. Yeah. I think we can agree that this one would be considered work, carrying all that stuff. This isn't exactly how many steps can you take it to be work. This is, this is pretty obvious.
Yeah. But it seems the Lord allows it right now because of this great momentous event when he is initiating his service to the people in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
Let's read the rest of the text, especially so that we can get to the voice of the Lord by the end of it. So this is picking up again at verse 84. This was the dedication offering for the altar on the day when it was anointed from the chiefs of Israel. 12 silver plates, 12 silver basins, 12 golden dishes, each silver plate weighing 130 shekels, and each basin 70. All the silver of the vessels, 2,400 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The 12 golden dishes full of incense, weighing 10 shekels apiece, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. All the gold of the dishes being 120 shekels. All the cattle for the burnt offering, 12 bulls, 12 rams, 12 male lambs a year old with their grain offering, and 12 male goats for a sin offering, and all the cattle for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 24 bulls, the rams 60, the male goats 60, the male lambs a year old 60. This was the dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. And when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the two cherubim, and it spoke to him. That takes us to the end of the chapter. So, Dr. Teets, we've got about 3 minutes here. We've talked about the offerings and the summary. Let's talk about that last verse that the Lord now speaks from the mercy seat.
We can talk about this verse and even function as our conclusion of our time together. After all of this, finally, we're here. The whole point of this is now the people can enter into God's presence. The Ark of the Covenant is there, which is the footstool of God's throne. It's where God is reigning among his people. The power of God's presence. The word for speak there is rendered in the English translation as hear the voice of being spoken. I forget what the ESV did there. I have a slightly different translation I'm looking at right now, is that there's a bit of a distance there. It's a niffle. It's a reflexive. So it is a bit of a distance there, but it's a distance by which God is speaking through all these means. And now here, God is speaking. God is leading. Exodus, this happened. We couldn't go in. Leviticus, this happens. The presence is here. And now Numbers gives us this account. Not only can we go in and be in God's presence, Leviticus, but now God is going to continue to lead and to speak and to use these means to guide us to the promised land. And we see that, and we think about this as functioning as a pattern, as a type for Christ, who is the great temple, is that, God now still is with us through these means of grace, through God's word that speaks to us and continues to guide us, because we're also in that wilderness where we're between our great saving event of our baptisms and are awaiting the promised land. So yeah, finally we're here. You can almost hear this sense of joy and relief at the end of this text. Everybody's gathered, all that excitement. We spent a lot of time on that. And then bam, take a deep breath. We get to hear God's voice talking to us, leading us, and guiding us.
Yeah. And I think, as we talked about at the beginning, with the glorious cloud and the glory of the Lord in the previous recounting, here it is the voice of the Lord, the word of the Lord that gets emphasized, which I find beautiful now in the New Testament, because that is exactly what I have. Even though I don't see a glorious cloud all the time, or maybe ever, I've got the word of the Lord, and in the word of the Lord, I have everything that I need, that great emphasis, although maybe this moment's like, wait, he just heard the voice? Exactly. He just heard the voice. That's what he needed. And what a beautiful way to end this chapter, that God is present with his people by his word for their sake, leading them through this wilderness. The Reverend Dr. Ryan Teets serves as Associate Professor of Exegetical Theology and Dean of Students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He has been helping us today to study Numbers chapter 7, verses 1 to 89. Dr. Teets, thanks for being our guest today.
Always an absolute joy to be able to join you.
I'm your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about number 7, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we read Numbers chapter 8. Thanks for spending your morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.